You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is hosting a two-hour live panel discussion this upcoming Earth Day, April 22nd, airing from 2 to 4 in the afternoon. Our panel is titled State of Oregon's Environment 2024. KBOO is organizing the event and the panelists. We will have 5 to 6 folks from different environmental issue disciplines. Each panelist will speak to their work and then be available for a Q&A session by phone with our KBOO audience. Again, this upcoming Earth Day, April 22nd, 2 to 4 p.m., tune in for our live panel, State of Oregon's Environment 2024. Our air room phone lines will be open by the end of the panel, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're invited to tune into KBOO's Blues Junction Saturday evening, April 20th at 5 o'clock for a musical conversation with Gulf Coast singer-songwriter Rich Layton. We'll explore the crossroads of twang and tremolo as Rich performs live in the KBOO Air Room. So remember, Blues Junction, Saturday, April 20th at 5 for Gulf Coast singer-songwriter Rich Layton. Once it gave you to
crawl, but the fat cats took it off. FM, Portland, power to the people.
As nations declared independence and liberated themselves from their colonizers, they initially largely imposed or maintained the legal system that they already had. So that meant that the banning of abortion continued along with most of the rest of the colonial legal system after a country had declared independence. From there on, things become a little bit more variable, particularly between Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm not enough of a historian to know how much of this may also emerge from different cultural and colonial systems between Spain and Portugal, on the one hand with Latin America, and England, France, and Holland, and the different colonial forces that were more focused on Sub-Saharan Africa.
That was sociologist Naomi Brain speaking with Sasha Lilly on Against the Grain about lessons in self-managed abortion. Feminist in the Global South showing the way forward for safe abortions outside the law. Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Denise Morris, your host for this April 15th Monday. This morning on The Old Mole, we rebroadcast Lessons in Self-Managed Abortion, hosted by Sasha Lilly, with guest sociologist Naomi Brain on Against the Grain Radio. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. It's a program of ideas, in-depth analysis, and commentary on political, economic, social, and cultural issues important to radical thinking and activism. Quote, while the Supreme Court considers restricting abortion pills, feminists in the Global South have shown the way forward for safe abortions outside of the law. Sociologist Naomi Brain has documented the efforts of networks and collectives of activists, some formed in the struggles against dictatorship in Latin America, who provide information, pills, and support in ending unwanted pregnancies without the need for medical personnel. Naomi Brain is the author of Abortion Beyond the Law, Building a Global Feminist Movement for Self-Managed Abortion, Verso 2023. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. You can hear the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m., and you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Sasha Lilly and Naomi Brain on Against the Grain.
Today on Against the Grain, while the Supreme Court weighs restricting abortion pills, feminists in the Global South have shown the way forward for safe abortions outside the law. Sociologist Naomi Brain has documented the efforts of networks and collectives of activists, some formed in the struggles against dictatorship in Latin America, who provide information and support for ending unwanted pregnancies without the need for medical personnel. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Access to abortion in the post-Roe era has become a battleground once more. But Naomi Brain argues that we should look south for guidance to a remarkable transnational network of feminist activists and collectives that have sprung up over the last two decades in Latin America, Africa, and beyond. In acts of quiet civil disobedience supported by these activists, people with unwanted pregnancies have found safe, self-managed medication abortions. The story of how these networks emerged is explored in Naomi Brain's Abortion Beyond the Law, Building a Global Feminist Movement for Self-Managed Abortion, published by Verso. Its author is Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College. Naomi, your book focuses on medication abortions that take place without any medical provider, using particular pills to end the pregnancy. Let me start with the obvious question. How safe are they?
They are completely safe. There is no risk of perforating the uterus, for example. This medication is as safe as things that are sold over the counter, and there is no risk. The closest thing there is to a risk from a self-managed abortion is that there's a possibility that sometimes it's incomplete, and that can easily be remedied with more pills or a trip to the urgent care. It is an abortion because it is an intentionally induced loss of a pregnancy, and in English we call that an abortion, as opposed to a miscarriage. But in terms of one's body, it is essentially the same process as a miscarriage. The pregnancy is interrupted and the uterus expels its contents. And part of the power of this as a strategy globally, including in the United States, is that if somebody takes the medication orally, as opposed to placing it in their vagina, and I should be precise, if they take the misoprostol orally rather than placing it in their vagina, when the contractions begin, if at some point they decide they want to go to an urgent care because they're concerned about something or they'd like the reassurance of a doctor checking that the miscarriage was complete, they can go to any urgent care and say that they have had a miscarriage. No doctor can tell the difference.
Well, we're going to be speaking a lot in the course of this hour about the kind of activism that has been taking place now for years in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa of supporting self-managed medication abortions. But I wanted to ask you before we get there to give us, if you can, a potted history of the origin of restrictions on abortion in Europe and the U.S. And this question is relevant to the discussion of abortion in places like Latin America and Africa, since these restrictions and notions were often exported via colonialism. Can you describe for us the genesis of such restrictions on abortion in Europe and in North America?
Sure. So the thumbnail sketch history is that prior to the second half of the 1800s, the second half of the 19th century, previous to that, abortion as a concept only applied after the fetus had quickened, which means that the pregnant person could perceive the motion of the fetus inside her body. Now, quickening is something that only a pregnant person knows when the baby has quickened. So what that means is that prior to the middle of the 1800s, any loss of a pregnancy prior to quickening was not considered an abortion. And in fact, it was often dubious. The exact start of a pregnancy was very unclear. The difference between a heavy period and a first trimester, what we would now call a first trimester miscarriage, completely obscure. And that management of reproduction was largely handled among women and midwives and other informal practitioners in the community and within families. Older women would help younger women. In the middle of the 1800s, the modern medical profession as we know it began to emerge in both in the United States and Western Europe and probably presumably in Australia and places like that. And one of the ways that in the United States, the emerging American Medical Association defined a boundary between itself and other practitioners was in fact around the issue of abortion and reproduction. So doctors, as they were consolidating what we now know as Western medicine, they needed to distinguish themselves from the many other practitioners who were out there in the community. And one of their particular targets were midwives. So they claimed essentially expertise over reproduction. And, you know, the risks of pregnancy, miscarriage, abortion, all of these things writ large in the 1800s were part of what enabled doctors to define those boundaries. The reality is that pregnancy is not terribly safe, particularly pregnancy 200 years ago was not a very safe experience. Neither was miscarriage. Neither was an intentional abortion. So doctors claimed an ability to make these things safer, in the process of which abortion was expanded as a concept to include the intentional ending of any pregnancy at pretty much any point. And those laws were extended through colonization out of Europe into Latin America, into sub-Saharan Africa, presumably into some parts of Asia. Wherever Western European nations had colonies, those abortion laws, as they were formed, were imposed on their colonies, as with all other kinds of laws. I mean, this was nothing special, right? The legal system that functioned in colonies was the legal system of the colonizer. So that included exporting abortion laws as they were created and exporting the concept of medicalization and that pregnancy was a medical event that needed to be inside the medical system. And all of this meant that by 1900, more or less, abortion was illegal throughout the United States and Western Europe, except if it was performed by a certified medical provider, and even then only really to save the life of the mother. So that brought us up to the laws that were extant in the United States in the early to mid-20th century.
Can one generalize about Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa? Obviously, highly different places even within those regions of the world. What the state of abortion restrictions have been through the 20th century and into the 21st?
So as nations declared independence and liberated themselves from their colonizers, they initially largely imposed or maintained the legal system that they already had. So that meant that the banning of abortion continued along with most of the rest of the colonial legal system after a country had declared independence. From there on, things become a little bit more variable, particularly between Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm not enough of a historian to know how much of this may also emerge from different cultural and colonial systems between Spain and Portugal, on the one hand, with Latin America, and England, France, and Holland, and the different colonial forces that were more focused on sub-Saharan Africa. So African countries achieved independence somewhat later than Latin American countries. and somewhere in the course of that process formed the African Union, and the African Union declared some minimal access to abortion as part of their charter, right? So to save the life of the mother, a non-viable fetus, and I think rape and incest. So these three highly common exceptions to a total ban on abortion, all of which are largely out of the control of the pregnant person and in the control of medical and in some cases legal authorities. So in Latin America, there has been much more diversity. Latin American countries declared independence sooner, and there was some variety of evolution of at least abortion law. I can't speak to the rest of the law. So, for example, Chile legalized therapeutic abortion in the 1930s, largely as a response to maternal mortality and an attempt to reduce maternal mortality. Therapeutic abortion essentially puts the decision in the hands of the doctor. It is if a woman needs an abortion for health reasons as determined by her doctor. So this actually meant that some Chilean women in their 70s told me that prior to the Pinochet coup, that abortion had become, at least in the major cities of Chile, considerably more accessible because the framework of a therapeutic abortion could be fairly flexible. So particularly for middle-class women, it was not hard to get an abortion legally within the medical system. I think that was less true in some other countries. Certainly it was not volunteered as a narrative. So abortion laws changed significantly in the second half of the 20th century across Latin America as abortion became a target of military dictatorships as part of cracking down. And you certainly saw that in Chile, where abortion was effectively completely banned under Pinochet. I'm less clear on what happened in Argentina or Ecuador. I think it was pretty much banned in Brazil. The amount of latitude around the restrictions is highly variable, and that has persisted into the 21st century. Self-managed medication abortion began informally in Brazil in the 1980s and began to spread through Latin America in a very informal fashion, but particularly through the Southern Cone. Brazil, Chile, somewhat in Argentina. This was something that preceded the formation of a feminist movement focused on self-managed abortion. I'm quite sure that it was in dialogue with emerging feminist activism in response to military dictatorships. I have been told that pharmacists played a significant role in this, but essentially one of the medications that is used in a classic medication abortion is misoprostol, which is also used for ulcers to treat a variety of other medical conditions. It also has other obstetric uses. Very helpfully, it is a treatment for postpartum hemorrhage. Misoprostol comes, at least when it's being sold as an ulcer medication, comes with a big fat black box on it that says it should not be used by pregnant women because it might cause a miscarriage. So in the 1980s and 90s, the use of this to induce a miscarriage began to spread in parts of Latin America. And honestly, we don't know where else it spread. Presumably, that's a black box that could be read as an invitation by almost anybody who thinks a miscarriage would be a convenient event.
Sociologist Naomi Brain is my guest. We're talking about her book, Abortion Beyond the Law, Building a Global Feminist Movement for Self-Managed Abortion. She's professor of sociology at Brooklyn College. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So how then did the use of medication for abortion start proliferating in Latin America and beyond the borders?
In the 1980s and 90s, there was this informal circulation of information. And let me say that this was so successful, with whatever role played by pharmacists, that maternal mortality in Brazil dropped measurably. And that was actually when this practice began to be visible. The response of the Brazilian government was to pull misoprostol from pharmacy distribution and make it a hospital-only drug. And this has happened in other countries where women have successfully used it in an autonomous fashion. However, simultaneously, in the 1980s, the French abortion pill RU486 was approved in France and began to be circulated. So the medication abortion, as we currently know it in the 21st century, is a combination of mifepristone, aka RU486, and misoprostol. So mifepristone ends the pregnancy, it impacts the hormone of woman's hormones, and it ends a pregnancy. Misoprostol then causes uterine contractions that expel the pregnancy. And the two together, if you go to an online telemedicine service or a clinic somewhere and you get a medication abortion, then you will get both of those medications. Take the mifepristone, 24 hours later, take the misoprostol, and you're done. Or the process is initiated, would be a better way to describe it. So around 1999, 2000, into the early 2000s, a Dutch doctor, Rebecca Gompertz, initiated first Women on Waves, which was a boat that would go to places, particularly around Europe and in the Mediterranean, where abortion was banned in the early 2000s, which included Portugal, where it was very hard to get and largely banned, and Poland was increasingly banning abortion, also a little bit into North Africa. And the boat would anchor in international waters and would essentially provide abortions to, largely in the form of medication, to women who could make contact with the boat. And there was a lot of drama. And for any feminist who was paying attention to the news, to international news and to feminist networks in the early 2000s, I mean, the abortion boat was a very big deal and everybody was super excited about the abortion boat. So Women on Waves fairly quickly by 2006 had spawned Women on Web, which was the first online telemedicine service that at least I think of any variety, and certainly the first online abortion telemedicine service. And the movement as we know it today essentially began, I'm rushing history a little bit here, compressing it, but essentially began when, let me say, the primarily Polish and Portuguese staff of Women on Web trained a group of young feminist activists in Ecuador in 2008 in the basics of medication abortion. This was during a period of progressive transformation in Ecuador. Rafael Correa was president, the constitution was being rewritten, everybody was feeling very liberated, and a group of young feminists they invited the boat. The boat had an accident. The boat couldn't make it. And in collaboration with the staff of Women on Web, they decided to launch the first ongoing, non-temporary safe abortion hotline. There had been other temporary ones as a way to make contact with the boat. But this was the first time the decision was made that the collective was just going to launch this hotline and run it. And they could get support from Women on Web when they had medical questions, but that this was going to be their thing and they were just going to do it and it was going to keep going. It was independent of the boat and independent of Women on Web. And this was the first time that had happened. So the launch was very successful. It included a lovely banner drop from a statue of the Virgin in Quito. And you could Google that. You can Google banner drop Safe Abortion Hotline Quito, and the image is all over the web. It's quite a lovely thing. It says Safe Abortion and the phone number, Aborto Seguro, and the phone number. And this launched a global movement. The Ecuadorian activists were very well networked, and this being 2008, they circulated a video via email of their launch. They conducted a workshop at a regional conference in early 2009. And that's a regional conference that emerged from feminist resistance to the dictatorships. EFLAC, Encuentro Feminista de Latinoamérica y el Caribe. And they did a workshop on abortion hotlines. You know, everybody I talked to who had been involved for 10 years or more really remember this. And this was the hot ticket of the workshop, the trainings that began to be done by the Ecuadorians and Women on Web. And the first couple of trainings were done jointly by the Ecuadorians and Women on Web. And then Women on Web got out of the way and was like, go ahead, you don't need us. And the Ecuadorians and then the Chileans and the Argentinians began to do trainings. And the knowledge was really claimed and adapted and evolved. The knowledge of how to run a hotline, the knowledge of how to support people with self-managed medication abortion. And the other little piece of history I should drop in there is that in Guanajuato, in Mexico, an NGO began to do a variation. They began to accompany women, which involves a more intensive relationship, and it doesn't involve a hotline, at least not initially. They were supporting women who had experienced sexual violence. And those women legally had the right to an abortion in Guanajuato. And they began to realize that the medication was available OTC in Guanajuato and throughout Mexico, over the counter in Guanajuato and really throughout Mexico. And essentially, they learned informally from the gynecologist, mostly by sitting through sessions with a gynecologist, accompanying women to the gynecologist. And so they heard all the instructions, they learned how to do it. They were like, oh, we don't actually need a gynecologist for this. So they began quietly accompanying women in Guanajuato. And in the I understand that in the 2009 workshop about the abortion hotlines, they also claimed a little bit of space and shared what they had been doing in Guanajuato. So the practice of accompaniment, which is to provide ongoing support, the difference between a hotline and accompaniment is that a hotline is a phone number that anybody can call. If they have questions while they're having an abortion, they can call back and say, hey, this is happening. Is this okay? You know, how many, I've gone through X number of maxi pads. Should I be worried? And the person answering the hotline can say, no, according to the WHO, you are not having a hemorrhage. That is within the normal realm, right? So a hotline is just a number you can call during the hours it's open, get information about how to use medication, talk about your situation, call back if you have questions during the process. Accompaniment also now often involves a telephone or text messages. But the key difference is that somebody is paired with a particular activist. So if I were to be accompanying somebody, we would have a conversation. I would check in with this person about when they're starting. And if I know that they began at a certain, that they took the misoprostol at a certain time, I might text them a few hours later and say, hey, how are you going? Have you started to have cramps yet? Any bleeding? How are you feeling? Do you have any questions? The essence of accompaniment is that you have a person who is committed to be with you through the process. And often that is by text message, particularly for first trimester abortions.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning, for our monthly rebroadcast of programming produced for Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. Lessons in Self-Managed Abortion originally aired on March 27, 2024, with Sasha Lilly and Naomi Brain, discussing how feminists in the Global South are showing the way forward for safe abortions outside the law. We will return to Lessons in Self-Managed Abortion, but first I want to let listeners know about an event this week at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. In its 13th year, the International Uranium Film Festival, which is based in Rio de Janeiro, comes to Portland as part of its multi-city U.S. tour. From Hiroshima, the Manhattan Project, Fukushima, and everything in between, where Oppenheimer dared not go, these films from around the world throw much-needed light on all nuclear issues. Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, directed by the Old Mole's own Jan Hocken and recipient of the Special Jury Award, is screening here in Portland, along with Atomic Cover-Up, directed by Greg Miller, and Demon Mineral, directed by Hadley Austin. That is the 2024 International Uranium Film Festival in its Portland tour, Wednesday, April 17th and Thursday, April 18th. Doors open at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, that's downtown Portland, Elliott Chapel on Southwest Salmon. Again, that is Wednesday, April 17th and Thursday, April 18th. Tickets for this event are $5 to $20 suggested donation at the door. And now we return to Lessons in Self-Managed Abortion with Sasha Lilly and Naomi Brain for Against the Grain Radio.
Well, let's just back up for a second. So if you're somebody in need of an abortion and you're in a country in Latin America, say, where abortion is criminalized. Now, obviously, this would vary from place to place, but generally speaking, how would you go about, number one, finding activists who could help you, who could disseminate this information for you? How would you find the hotline? How would you secure the medicines and be and put in touch with someone who would accompany you through the process if that's what you wanted and that was available?
The hotlines have websites and are all over the internet. So at this point, you get in touch with a hotline by Googling abortion hotline. And given that it is more than 15 years now since the first abortion hotlines went up in Latin America, it is fairly well known that they exist. In 2008, 2009, 2010, sort of the early years of the hotlines, when fewer people had reliable access to the internet, there was also a lot of handing out of flyers and stenciling the phone number and things like that, especially in more low-income areas and less urban areas. In the early years of the hotlines, there was a systematic effort to get the information out. Now there is more dependence on the internet to provide that, to serve that function, since Googling is an increasingly global activity. So you get the phone number, you call. You might have gotten it in 2009. You might have gotten it from a stencil on the side of a building or on a sidewalk in a low-income neighborhood of Santiago or Valparaíso in Chile. So people could get the phone number. They might also have gotten it from a friend who said, here, you can call these guys. There has been varying levels of cooperation from inside the medical system, informally at least, with counselors and whatnot who will say, okay, if you're not sure whether you want this, I can't help you, but these people can. So information spreads. And this is one of the functions of progressive, often low-level frontline medical practitioners and counselors, social workers, is to facilitate this kind of thing. I mean, in New York in the 80s and early 90s, in the Catholic hospitals, including St. Vincent's, most of the people who did counseling around HIV joked about having two drawers. There was the drawer of supplies that they opened if anybody from the church was anywhere in the vicinity of their office that did not have condoms. There was another drawer somewhere that they could open under other circumstances that did have condoms. Right, so people understand the rules and find ways to provide people with the support and assistance they need. So that's how somebody gets information. If you Google safe abortion or abortion hotline or abortion accompaniment in Argentina, you get the Sacaristas website immediately. It has contact information for accompaniment collectives, acompañantes, in every large city and many small cities. I counted at one point when I was writing the book, and I don't remember whether there were 25 different collectives listed, but on that order. And I haven't counted recently. There may be more. So you get the information, you get the contact information. If it's a hotline, you just call the hotline. They talk you through. They may ask you about your situation. They may talk to you for a little while if you want to, or they may just say, hey, here's the instructions. Boom, boom, boom. Can I email it to you or text it to you? Some people, all they want is the instructions, and they're good to go. other people want to have a conversation. With the accompaniment collectives, again, you call a phone number as a starting point. Then there is more likely to be a workshop with a few people who are looking for information at about the same time, during the course of which people get paired up, either with each other to accompany each other or with an activist.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with sociologist Naomi Brain about abortion beyond the law and the lessons that can be learned from the proliferation of self-managed medication abortions in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. She's the author of Abortion Beyond the Law, which is published by Verso. So you were just describing what someone might do if, and has done, I mean, because you're talking about an evolving experience that has taken place in Latin America and in Africa over the last several decades, and how someone would go about obtaining information about a self-managed abortion in a place where such abortions are criminalized. So given that, how then would they obtain the pills, which would be necessary, obviously, for the process? And how do the activists who are providing this information protect themselves from being arrested or prosecuted as they're conveying this information and perhaps the medications themselves?
Sharing information is legal, full stop. Okay, so as long as you are sharing the World Health Organization protocol for the use of medication, that is legal. It is legal globally with right to information. And nobody has been prosecuted for sharing information. Not in Poland, not in Ireland when it was still illegal, not even in the United States, and not even in the countries where, like El Salvador and Honduras, where abortion for any reason is still banned, even to save the life of the mother. So the sharing of information is legal. The pills are where one runs into legal challenges and complications, because providing prescription medication without a prescription takes you into different legal territory than sharing health information that is widely available through multiple sources. So in many countries in Latin America and some in sub-Saharan Africa, misoprostol is still available over the counter. It has sometimes been pulled and made less available. In Kenya and Nigeria, where I spoke with activists, they explained to me that, you know, it is technically available, but that as the knowledge about the use of it as an abortifacient has become more widespread, it has become less accessible. The international telemedicine services are one of the standard sources. So Women on Web, Women Help Women. Women Help Women in particular is very well networked. It was founded by the staff of, by the original staff of Women on Web. They sort of broke off to do something slightly different. They also run a telehealth service, and they are very well connected with the hotlines and the accompaniment groups internationally, transnationally. And they work with them to make medication available in a whole variety of ways. And part of doing the research on this was not to ask too many questions about pills, because that is the information that you don't want to get on tape and you don't want to get too many details about. So I know that Women Help Women works with people to maintain supplies of medication, and that they in fact have a doctor who is licensed to prescribe internationally, and that they use that in order to facilitate reliable access.
A more complex question is, assuming obviously different places have different histories, but if there are commonalities that you can draw, you know, what you're describing, what you've written about in Abortion Beyond the Law is a series of networks that cross borders throughout Latin America, sub-Saharan Africa, that support people having self-managed abortions. How were these networks built? And did you find that certain kinds of political cultures needed to exist, generally speaking, for such networks of grassroots support to be sustained?
It's an interesting question. So they formed in slightly different ways depending on which subcontinent. And let me say that there are abortion hotlines in Indonesia and other parts of Asia. I did not interview them, so I don't know too much about them, but they do exist. This is not just a Latin American and Sub-Saharan African thing. So in Latin America, the resistance to the dictatorships, and this is a central historical element of the 20th century Latin America, is that much of Latin America was under dictatorship at some point in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And feminism emerged within the region as part of the resistance to these dictatorships. And feminist networks emerged, including this conference that's shorthanded as EFLAC, Encuentro Feminista de Latinoamérica y el Caribe. So that conference first met in 80 or 81, I think in Bogota, as a place for activists to come together in mutual support, in resistance to the situations they were dealing with. And that conference continues to today, every few years. So in Latin America, the core networks emerged out of resistance to dictatorship and were maintained through a variety of informal and formal means, which is why the Ecuadorians were able to share their launch video by email, is because people knew people and off it went. So that's the Latin American history in a nutshell. And so there is a culture of cross-border communication, a culture of alliance. And these countries, with the exception of Brazil, are not as huge, for the most part, as either Mexico or the United States. So cross-border alliance is much easier with shared language, shared borders that are within reach. People go to college in different countries, people travel, and there are robust feminist communication. The majority of the mutual aid that exists in Latin America across collectives in different countries, in Ecuador and Bolivia and Colombia and Chile and Argentina, etc., those are mostly anchored in informal networks. Occasionally they create a formal network for some period of time, and then when it's done whatever it is they needed it to do, it dissolves. Sub-Saharan Africa is a little bit different. They have a different history, right? Independence was achieved later. There was not the same universal history of dictatorship during a period of time. There have been regional transnational networks of African feminist activists doing reproductive justice-related work, often shorthanded as sexual and reproductive health and rights. So those networks formed, some of it formed in response to the HIV epidemic, right, which was heavily about sexual transmission throughout Africa and was devastating. So particularly in the parts of Africa where the HIV epidemic had a profound impact, many of those networks, the networks that formed often and the organizations that formed were often involved in one way or another with HIV education. In parts of Africa where HIV was less of a presence, in West Africa, they formed around sexual health and rights in general. These were not two separate networks. Everybody was working together and in communication with each other and pooling resources and sharing skill sets. And when a group of Women on Web staff did a training in Tanzania, I think it was in 2010 or 2011, people came from all over the region and were trained, and then proceeded to support each other in forming, when the first network launched, when the first hotline launched, they shared their experience with everybody else, and then they supported the second hotline to launch, and the first and the second supported the third, which replicates essentially what happened in Latin America, but in a slightly different context. Now, one of the things that's really important to say about sub-Saharan Africa in relation to HIV is that the organizations that provide treatment for HIV cannot be part of this network because of the global gag rule. Every time there is a Republican president of the United States, they reimpose the global gag rule. The global gag rule is similar to the Hyde Amendment domestically. It bars the use of certain funding streams for anything related to abortion. So what that means for sub-Saharan Africa is that any organization that is doing HIV treatment or wants to be able to do HIV treatment, so not just education, but to provide care, cannot provide any kinds of care or even referrals for abortion services, because whenever the global gag rule goes in, they would lose all of their funding through the international, through PEPFAR, which is the main international funding stream. I also understand that they are part of, that outreach workers of all varieties share information with women who need it about all the different kinds of health care they might need.
Well, staying with just what you were talking about, the forces that emanate from the United States and the forces of the right in this country, the U.S. Supreme Court is currently hearing arguments against access to mifepristone, one of the pills used for medication abortions, and their ruling is expected this summer. We've been discussing the work of activists in Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa to provide abortion access, self-managed abortions to people in those regions due to the criminalization of abortion. Things have, of course, changed dramatically in the United States in the last couple of years. And I wanted to ask you, what is at stake here with the Supreme Court, first off, and they're weighing in on one of the pillars of self-managed abortion?
There's a few different directions outwards from your question, all of which I think are important. And let me flag each one first, and then I can delve into it a little bit. So one is literally what is at stake in terms of the options within the United States for medication abortion. The other is the implications of this Supreme Court hearing for the pharmaceutical industry writ large. Personally, I think that is going to have a bigger impact on the outcome than anything to do with mifepristone. And third, much of the mifepristone in circulation in the world does not emanate from the United States, and therefore will not be affected by Supreme Court rulings of any variety. So to begin with the first one, if the Supreme Court, you know, upholds the lower court decision, the biased lower court decision that overturns FDA process, and the FDA is super conservative about mifepristone even to this day, then that risks pushing mifepristone access back. And the two landmarks are during the pandemic, there was a temporary suspension of the rule that mifepristone could only be handed out and taken in front of a medical provider. So it used to be, prior to the pandemic, somebody used to have to go to a clinic, they would be handed a dose of mifepristone, they would take it in front of the medical provider, and then they would be given misoprostol to take home. So during the pandemic, they gave a temporary suspension of that rule so that both mifepristone and misoprostol could be mailed, since we really didn't want people walking into medical clinics unless they absolutely had to. And then subsequently, that regulatory shift was shifted from an emergency basis to an ongoing basis. So that's why it's easy to mail mifepristone and misoprostol, and you can get a little package, the full package of abortion pills in the mail. So that was the most recent marker. The previous marker, 2016, was when the FDA extended licensed use of mifepristone from 7 weeks up until the 7th week of pregnancy. They extended to the 10th week of pregnancy. In the rest of the world, it's used throughout the first trimester, and it is even used in the second trimester. So, the U.S. is already restrictive with 10 weeks, but so the Supreme Court could roll back the mail order, and it could roll back all the way to 7 weeks. And we don't know what they're going to do. Either one would dramatically impact access. The mail order thing might be the more profound limitation on access, though it's hard to split that hair, in part because people do use medications off-label, so to speak, meaning outside of their narrowly defined use parameters. So that's the direct issue. The secondary issue is that if the Supreme Court chooses to overturn an FDA regulation, this is going to have profound impact on the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, because there is absolutely no reason to think that that would stop with mifepristone. You know, anti-abortion forces would say this has nothing to do with the pharmaceutical industry, it has nothing to do with the FDA, this is just about mifepristone, but of course it has everything to do with the pharmaceutical industry. If one FDA ruling can be overturned, so can others. My personal bet is that that is going to have a profound impact on the ruling. It doesn't mean they're not going to cause problems, particularly in relation to mail order, but that overturning an FDA decision has profound implications for one of the largest and wealthiest industries in the United States. Let's just leave that there. But the other comment is, in addition to the fact that people do medication abortions with misoprostol only safely all over the world, a vast amount of the mifepristone that is in circulation globally comes out of India. India is the primary manufacturer of generic drugs of all varieties. A great deal of the mifepristone that is in circulation in the United States has its origins in India or somewhere else outside of the United States. And let me just say, that is because there are activists circulating packets of abortion pills that include mifepristone that did not begin with a prescription written by a doctor inside the United States.
Well, let me end then by asking you directly what the lessons could be that could be drawn from the experience and networks of these collectives of activists throughout Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and beyond, helping people get self-managed medication abortions. What the lessons would be if access to medication abortions becomes highly constrained in the United States?
One thing I will say is that there are already very active alliances between feminists in Latin America, especially in Mexico, and feminists in the United States that began after SB 8 in 2021. So those networks, those alliances are in place, and they are a source of pills for people in the United States. I do not know the details of how they cross the border, and I should not. But at any rate, medication is on the move. Medication also comes through Aid Access, which is in one of the international telehealth platforms that will ship to the United States. So activists are already learning the lessons of Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa, which is that you can do this, that it is legal to share information. People have been sharing information very publicly in the United States about how to use pills safely outside the medical system in a self-managed abortion. No one has been prosecuted. Full stop. No one. People are terrified, but the legal track record is very different from their terror. The people who are at most risk are honestly the people who are having abortions, but all of the prosecutions to date in the last 20 years were all pre-Dobbs. They all involved people with pregnancies of 17 weeks or more, so they were second trimester situations of self-managed abortion. Self-managed abortion is not explicitly banned anywhere in the United States except for one state, which I think is Nevada, but that should be checked before anybody counts on that. But only one state bans self-managed abortion. Other states ban the work of medical practitioners. They are not technically banning the work of pregnant people. And in fact, a prosecutor in Texas had their legal license threatened because they filed charges of abortion against a woman right around the times the Dobbs decision came down. And she was released because it was pointed out that Texas does not bar somebody from ending their own pregnancy. It bars somebody from helping somebody else end their pregnancy. So we need to be less terrified. We need to understand what is legal and what isn't and make use of that information. We need to not assume that pushing a boundary will automatically result in incarceration. And we need to do our homework, right? I'm not suggesting that people recklessly push boundaries. People should be in touch with If, When, How, which is essentially the legal collective that is doing most of the work inside the United States around self-managed abortion. They should talk to If, When, How if they have any questions about what they're considering doing. They should check out the Digital Defense Fund. They are the people who will help you with your online security, right? I'm not saying people should be reckless, but for the most part, people are living in a state of terror in the United States at a level that is unreasonable. There are people close to the ground who are doing a great deal. They are not terrified, but far too many feminists are far too terrified about what might happen. And we all need to educate ourselves and learn from our sisters in the global South, which is that don't give the state any more power than it has. Claim the power you have.
Naomi Brain, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been great.
Naomi Brain is the author of Abortion Beyond the Law, Building a Global Feminist Movement for Self-Managed Abortion. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to that at againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks to Sasha Lilly and Naomi Brain, talking this morning about lessons in self-managed abortion. Feminists in the Global South, showing the way forward for safe abortions outside the law. This is a rebroadcast of a conversation first aired on Against the Grain, March 27th, 2024. Against the Grain is a weekly radio show hosted by Sasha Lilly and Sia Song on KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. You can look for The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download The Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. Thanks for listening, and tune in to The Old Mole next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective. To end today's programming, I want to remind listeners about an upcoming event this week. In its 13th year, the International Uranium Film Festival, which is based in Rio de Janeiro, comes to Portland as part of its multi-city U.S. tour. From Hiroshima to Manhattan Project, Fukushima, and everything in between, where Oppenheimer dared not go, these films from around the world throw much-needed light on all nuclear issues. Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, directed by The Old Mole's own Jan Hocken and recipient of the Special Jury Award, is screening here in Portland along with Atomic Cover-Up, directed by Greg Miller, and Demon Mineral, directed by Hadley Austin. This event is coming up this Wednesday, April 17th, and Thursday, April 18th. Doors open at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland, Southwest Salmon Street. Tickets are $5 to $20 suggested donation at the door. Come on out and support this great event and the filmmakers who made it possible. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings